Okay, over to you, Francis.
Okay. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this 95th webinar on the secret doctrine. I've decided to let go of the references to the Mori Federation and to the Mercara.us. You've heard it, many, many, many times. And so I think it's not necessary to continue with that little introductory line. So we're just going to go straight into the next part of the presentation, which is this month we begin a biography entitled HPB, The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky by Sylvia Cranston. So I did some research on these biographies, and this is sort of universally presented as being the most even-handed, fairest from either super pro HPB or super against HPB. This is a very well-crafted, fair and even biography. So, and it's also quite extensive and it's well recognized. So I just decided that we would move into that. As you know, last month, Colonel Olcott described how he became aware of HPB's death, and it seemed like a really good time to move on from that five-volume series. We were well into volume four at that point. So, in this book, after describing Blavatsky's royal heritage, her mother was a renowned novelist, compared, for instance, to George Sand, and her grandmother was royalty. She was Princess Helena Pavlovna Fadayev. So, after a chapter on that, the book begins to describe young Helena's childhood, and that's where we'll step in. And if I could get a reader, please.
I'll start.
Okay.
It is only when Helena Petrovna is 9 that we begin to learn about her personal characteristic. Vera, Helena's sister, thus far has been of no help, being 4 years her junior. But Aunt Nadja, 2 years Helena's senior, appears to have remembered a good deal. She informed A.P. Sennett, Helena's first biographer, in Helena's childhood, all her sympathies and attractions went out towards people of the lower class. She had always preferred to play with her servants' children rather than with her equals, and had to be constantly watched for fear she should escape from the house to make friends with ragged street boys. So later on in life, she continued to be drawn in sympathy towards those who were in a humbler station of life than herself, and she showed a pronounced indifference to the nobility to which by birth she belonged.
Thank you, BL. New reader.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Here I am. Yes. She was the strangest girl, one with a distinct dual nature, one mischievous, the other mystical and metaphysically inclined. No schoolboy was ever more uncontrollable or full of the most unimaginable pranks. At the same time, when the paroxysm of mischief making had run its course, no old scholar could be more assiduous in his study. She could not be prevailed upon to give up her books, which she would devour night and day, as long as the impulse lasted. The enormous library of her grandparents seemed then hardly large enough to satisfy her cravings. One thing particularly caused trouble. Helena had the uncomfortable habit of telling people to their faces what she thought of them, something not done in polite society. This embarrassed many and placed her own relatives in a very awkward situation. Yet she was so kind and so daring that she was ready to give anything away to the needy, to do everything for a friend, and decide upon any action in defense of the injured. While she never remembered evil or injury done to herself.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, so I think it's going to be really interesting to follow Cranston's biography. Okay, we began our last session by contrasting the fourth and fifth root races, the Atlantean and the Aryan. On this, HPB says, in our present all material fifth race, the earthly spirit of the fourth is still strong in us. But we are approaching the time when the pendulum of evolution will direct its swing decidedly upwards, bringing humanity back on a parallel line with the primitive third root race in spirituality. So those last two words are key. This is a vibrational shift or assessment when probably in the sixth root race we regain the spiritual level of the third root race, we'll have also developed a vastly more advanced mental awareness. We then learned that immediately following human individualization, when our causal bodies had only just come into being, the indwelling human ego was not yet capable of self-directed activity. And so it was the solar angels themselves who inhabited humanity's physical forms and directly bore the burden of developing man's incipient consciousness. This is quite different than the situation now, where the human soul is incarnate, and the solar angel overshadows the personality. At this time, because there was absolutely no development whatsoever, the solar angels themselves literally incarnated in order to start the process of becoming after this great initiation called individualization. Okay, next, HPB reveals that in the latter days of the fourth root race, the earth condensed and stabilized, and the form-building lunar petries perfected their work. As a result, human bodies became more symmetrical, balanced, and suited to a finer level of expression. But the consequent development of lower mind obscured soul contact because of humanity's growing preoccupation with desire, material ambition, and separative thinking, which all acted to block the higher influence. This was a necessary stage, not a mistake, during which engagement with the outer environment was emphasized. It was the purpose of humanity at that stage. HPB says the three middle principles in Earth and man became, with every race, more material. The soul stepping back to make room for the physical intellect. The essence of elements becoming the material and composite elements now known. We then learned that early in man's development, the dhyanis, or mind-born sons, which form our five middle principles, projected an ethereal outline of humanity into denser substance. It was literally a process of projecting a shadow of themselves. These archetypal shadows then acted as a blueprint for the nature spirits or elemental intelligences to actually fashion the dense physical bodies of man from matter. We then took a look at the three groups responsible for creating humanity: the Dhyan Chohans, who project the etheric double, the Petris, or nature spirits, that build and animate the physical body, and then on the return evolutionary stage, the Manasaputras, who impart the life essence, the spark of mind. HP then describes the quote unquote breath of life, distinguishing it from prana, its physical etheric counterpart. And yeah, there was some discussion on this idea of the breath of life. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So, after a footnote on the difference between Ruach, Pneuma, and Spiritus, which we looked at last time, we now move back to the main text, which follows on the statement from the previous paragraph, quote, "Indeed, the verse is made to say, the wind bloweth where it listeth, instead of, the spirit goeth where it willeth." Quite a difference, as in the original and also in the translation of the Greek Eastern Church. So this statement sets up the reading that we'll start with today. Could we get a reader, please?
Heliosol, can you read that for us, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
That is the whole page here, right? That is in the bold print, correct? I'm thinking, right? Okay.
It's the middle section.
Oh, middle section.
Yeah,
Okay.
not the verse or the.
Thus, the philosophy of psychic, spiritual, and mental relations with man's physical functions is an almost inextricable confusion. Neither the old Aryan nor the Egyptian psychology are now properly understood, nor can they be assimilated without accepting the esoteric septenary, or at any rate, the Vedantic quinquapartite division of the human inner principles, failing which it will be forever impossible to understand the metaphysical and purely psychic and even physiological relation between Dhyan Chohans, or angels, on the one plane and humanity on the other. No Eastern Aryan esoteric works are so far published, but we possess the Egyptian papyri, which speaks clearly. Should I read further?
Yes.
The learned and very philosophical author of New Aspect of Life would impress upon his reader that the nephesh
But I'm not
Gia.
sure where you're reading now. You just said no Eastern Aryan esoteric works are so far published. We possess the East Egyptian papyri, which speaks clearly and then continues
Yes, see,
of
which
the
speaks
seven.
clearly. I went on another page, sorry. So I will repeat the sentence. It's kind of linked
Okay.
together. No Eastern Aryan esoteric works are so far published, but we possess the Egyptian papyri, which speak clearly of the seven principles of the seven souls of man. The Book of the Dead gives a complete list of the transformation that every defunct undergoes while divesting himself one by one of all those principles, materialized for the sake of clearness into ethereal entities or bodies.
Thank you, Irene.
Thank you.
Okay, so first, thus, the philosophy of psychic, spiritual, and mental relations with man's physical functions is in almost inextricable confusion. This followed that the description of this idea that this gospel verse has been distorted from the wind blows where it lists us instead of the spirit goeth where it willeth. So thus the philosophy of psychic, spiritual, and mental relations with man's physical function is an almost inextricable confusion. So HPB here points out that the modern philosophy and psychology have failed to provide a coherent explanation of how the inner principles relate to the outer body. The confusion, quote unquote, is almost inextricable because there is such a lack of understanding of the true ontology of how the higher principles relate to the lower, that even serious thinkers struggle to untangle their understanding. This confusion is heightened by the Western tendency to either reduce consciousness to brain function, very popular ideas still, or to treat soul and spirit as vague abstractions, without recognizing, let alone understanding, their true occult structure and interaction. Next. Neither the old Aryan nor the Egyptian psychology are now properly understood. So by Aryan psychology, HPB is most likely referring to Vedantic and Vedic models of consciousness. By Egyptian psychology, she's referring to ancient Egyptians' understanding of the principles of man, including their sevenfold system of soul expression, which could be found articulated in Gerald Massey's Natural Genesis. Both of these systems, which give precise metaphysical maps of the human constitution, have been either misinterpreted, lost, or distorted by modern theologians, anthropologists, and scholars. Next, nor can they be assimilated without accepting the esoteric septenary, or at any rate, the Vedantic quinquepartite division of the human inner principles. That just means fivefold. So, nor can the Aryans and Egyptian systems be assimilated without accepting the esoteric septenary, refers to the sevenfold constitution of man taught in theosophy and other esoteric traditions. And if one cannot accept the septenary model, we are told, then at a minimum, one must accept the Vedantic fivefold division of the human being, whose principles are called koshas. And I think it's worth taking a minute to read these. So if we could get a reader for the right-hand column.
Marianne, can you read that, please? Well, she's not. And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I'll try. Anadamaya, the bliss sheath, the innermost sheath closest to Atman, associated with spiritual joy, transcendence, and pure being. Vijnanamaya, wisdom sheath, seat of an intellect, discernment, and higher knowledge, governs the intuitive insight and spiritual discrimination. Manomaya, mental sheath, contains thoughts, emotions, and sensory impressions responsible for cognition, desire, and egoic identity. Pranamaya, vital sheath, composed of life force energy prana, regulates breathing, circulation, and energetic flow. Anamaya, physical sheath, the gross body made of food and matter, engages with the material world through the senses.
I like this illustration because it puts the highest sheath at as the smallest, suggesting an interior reality, like the point in the center. Usually these charts do just the opposite. The greater realities are expressed in the outermost figures, but here all of these are internal to the Anamaya, the physical form, which is here represented in red. Okay. So next up, failing which meaning the recognition of either the seven or fivefold. It will be forever impossible to understand the metaphysical and purely psychic and even physiological relations between the Dian Chohans, or angels, on the one plane and humanity on the other. So without the proper metaphysical map, the true nature or even existence of certain spiritual relationships will remain permanently obscured. The Dian Chohans, or Devas, relate to humanity through a multidimensional interplay that includes the metaphysical, psychic, and physiological domains. Metaphysically, Dian Chohans are co-evolving intelligences within the hierarchy of our planet. Psychically, they act as guides and inspirers of higher consciousness, influencing the intuitive and mental planes through subtle impressions and spiritual impulses. Physiologically, they serve as regulators of the subtle forces that shape our vitality and form by interacting with the etheric and energetic systems that sustain our lives. Any thoughts or questions? As always, dialogue is more interesting than monologue. So if you feel so moved, right away, Nadell, yes.
Are the Devas, the Dhyani Chohans, or the angels, are they the same hierarchy as the masters, or is it a parallel hierarchy?
Masters belong to the human line, and the Dhyani Chohans belong to the Devic line.
So they're two separate lines. They're not sort of, they don't sort of come together to like the sixth initiation or something like that.
Sixth initiation, they come together.
Okay.
But there's like a lot of mystery connected with just what that looks like. These are individual, extremely highly evolved beings that form this, that come together in this hermaphroditic marriage of energies, you know, and then are able to function in both the Deva and human realms. But generally speaking, at least at this time, in this fourth chain, they're completely separate lines. And yet they make our forms, they make up our whole form aspect. But in terms of our consciousness, we are necessarily blocked from direct perception of the Devic line. Okay, and Irene?
Yeah, I have a quick question. It will be forever impossible to understand the metaphysical and purely psychic and even physiological relation between Dian Chohans or angels on one plane and humanity on another. So when it says forever impossible, that means it for the end of time, because
no, okay, that's conditional on the previous statement, which was, let's go back there, hang on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We go back, we have to go back to nor can they be assimilated without accepting the esoteric septenary, or at any rate the Vedantic kinkapartite quinque partite, division of the human principles, failing which, in other words, if they don't at least have this fivefold or sevenfold understanding, then we have this condition where it'll be forever impossible to understand
Okay.
this.
So that means if
It doesn't
we
mean
start
that
to
all of us.
understand, So that means whoever begin understanding that contact might happen.
Well, it starts with becoming familiar with the system of either the fivefold or sevenfold principles of humanity. And then from that understanding, we eventually gain contact, soul contact, and we very gradually over time learn about the interrelation of all these principles, right? And then we have. We're in line then with the reality of our greater system.
So this is only the question of evolution, correct?
Yeah, it's a
Okay.
question of evolution,
Okay.
you know. But yeah, this failing, which is means if you don't understand the seven or fivefold system, then it'll be forever impossible to understand the metaphysical and metaphysical, psychic, and physiological relationships between the angels and humanity is basically what he's saying. Okay, a bunch of
Thank you.
questions here. BL, do you want to monitor this?
Barbara, please go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering about the role of the Manasaputras that in some literature suggests are really the builders of the design for the fifth root race. And I'm wondering about the chart of involution and evolution that showed the fifth root race is etheric. So it seems to be the defining characteristic of higher mind and the architecture of higher mind. Including the causal body that is definitive for this root race.
Yeah, okay, that the etheric connection would be through the mental etheric, right? Because the Manasaputras, who are these great fire devas who bestow mind, they are in DK's teaching, they're the solar angels, right? So
Okay.
these solar angels acquiesce to plant the spark of mind in individual man. And humanity as a whole. So this great group of angels acquiesces to do this. That happened in three different stages in time. They have their orientation to the higher mental plane, even though on their own levels they are essentially Atma Buddha monastic. But in relation to the human being that they are overshadowing, that they are focused through the causal body, even though they are not themselves that causal body. Does that answer your question? I felt like there's another question in there.
No, thank you very much. That's
You're
helpful.
welcome. Yes. Okay, next.
Well,
Yeah.
Joe?
Oh, yes, thank you. I have a weird question. A number of years ago, I had an important dream, I thought, in which I described it was a five or a seven, and I've never set aside the five or the seven. And this is the first time that it comes to my mind that indeed, as human beings, we have seven chakras, but maybe. Not the Vedic, the Devic may use seven and the human use five. Have you ever thought about that?
I think if it was anything, it'd be the other way around. But usually, the relation between five and seven is the five planes that are definitely oriented towards humanity. In other words, the lowest five planes are planes of human endeavor, and then the highest two plane, which are the last, the highest, the monadic and Udi planes of the cosmic physical plane, take us beyond. Into the higher kingdoms of nature. So, in terms of principles of expression of the monad, then it begins with the atmic. I even have a chart of it in here, which we'll get to today, and then moves downward from there. So that's one way of seeing the five and the seven, is the five is that which particularly relates to humankind. It's even the number of humanity, five fingers, the five limbs, including the head, right? The five elements, and that the seven then takes us, are the method by which we move up and beyond that.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, let's see here. Easter. All right, next, no Eastern Aryan esoteric works are so far published, but we possess the Egyptian papyri, which speak clearly of the seven principles of the seven souls of man. So, though the esoteric texts of the Aryan traditions, those that detail the inner constitution of man, have not been made public, Egyptian papyri are accessible and contain explicit references to the sevenfold nature of a human being. The phrase seven souls of man reflects the Egyptian understanding that the human being is composed of multiple subtle bodies or principles, each with its own function and destiny. That's all I'll say right now. We're going to be coming back to this chart. The footnote referenced by the phrase seven souls of man states Vida in part two, book two, seven souls of man. The divisions made respectively by Messrs. Gerald Massey and Franz Lambert. Actually, there is no section in the Secret Doctrine, second volume, Secret Doctrine, entitled The Seven Souls of Man. HVP is probably referring to section 25 of volume two, called The Mysteries of the Hebdomad, which means sevenfold, and maybe more specifically to a subsection called The Seven Souls of the Egyptologists, which cites Gerald Massey's lecture down here at the bottom, entitled The Seven Souls of Man and Their Culmination in the Christ, which explores Egyptian and Gnostic ideas of layered soul structures. Now we're going to resist doing a deep dive into Gerald Massey's paper and instead offer a chart that compares Massey's ideas on the seven souls of the ancient Egyptians and the seven theosophical principles that are similar, though not identical, to those Egyptian ideas. So if we could get a reader, I'm going to read this top section, which just says these are the Egyptian soul aspect as given by Massey. These are the functions of those Egyptian souls. And then in the second half of the column, we have Blavatsky's principles and their function and symbolism. I'm seeing a hand here.
Yeah, I was go ahead, please. Russell.
Thank you. So I read by column or by lines?
You read horizontally
Horizontally.
number
Okay.
one down to
Okay.
number seven. I think
All
that's
right.
Yeah, you could do it both ways, but I think
No,
that.
that makes sense also because it's kind of structured like on the same. Okay, so Sekhem, spiritual power, divine energy. Blavatsky principle, Atma. Function and symbolism, pure spirit, eternal divine essence. Two, Masis, Ak, immortal soul, transfigured essence. Blavatsky principle, Buddhi. Function, symbolism, intuition, wisdom, spiritual consciousness. Three, Ku. Function and symbolism, luminous intelligence, higher mind. Blavatsky principle, Manas. Functional and symbolism, thinking principles, dual in nature. Four, Masses, Sahu, vehicle for resurrection, purified astral form. Blavatsky principle, Linga Sharira. Function and symbolism, subtle body, bridge between physical and mental. Five, Ba, individual personality, emotional self. Blavatsky principle, Kama. Function and symbolism, passions, desire, emotional drives. Six, Masses, Ka. Function symbolism, life force, etheric twin. Blavatsky principle, Prana. Function symbolism, life energy or breath. Seven, Masses, Khat. Function and symbolism, material body, subject to decay. Blavatsky principles, Rupa. Function and symbolism, gross physical form.
Thank you, Irene. Okay, back to the text. The Book of the Dead gives a complete list of the transformations that every defunct undergoes while divesting himself one by one of all those principles materialized for the sake of clearness into ethereal entities or bodies. So the Egyptian Book of the Dead outlines the post-mortem journey of the soul. The transformations are the stages of purification and separation that the deceased undergoes after death. Each transformation corresponds to the shedding of a principle, as we went through them here, a layer of identity or a karmic imprint. Though differing in detail, this process mirrors the theosophical doctrine of death, where the soul gradually divests itself of the lower vehicles to return to its spiritual source. Okay? Any thoughts or questions about any of this? Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Ben, can you read that for us, please?
We must moreover remind those who try to prove that the ancient Egyptians knew nothing of and did not teach reincarnation, that the soul, the ego or self of the defunct is said to be living in eternity. It is immortal, coeval with and disappearing with the soul or boat, that is, for the cycle of necessity. This soul emerges from the Tiau, the realm of the cause of life, and joins the living on earth by day, and returns to the Tiau every night. This expresses the periodical existences of the ego, Book of the Dead. The shadow, the astral form, is annihilated, devoured by the uraeus. The manas will be annihilated. The two twins, the fourth and fifth principles, will be scattered. But the soul bird, the divine swallow, and the uraeus of flame, Manas and Atma Buddhi, will live in eternity for they are their mother's husbands.
Okay, a lot here to unpack. So first, we must moreover, remind those who try to prove that the ancient Egyptians knew nothing of and did not teach reincarnation, that the soul, the ego or self, of the defunct is said to be living in eternity. It is immortal, coeval with and disappearing with the solar boat, that is, for the cycle of necessity. Okay, so the overwhelming consensus among mainstream Egyptologists like E.A. Wallace Budge, very famous, is that the ancient Egyptians did not believe in reincarnation. However, there are exceptions to this mainstream belief, like R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, who often referred to the quote-unquote cycle of becoming, which aligns closely with the theosophical cycle of necessity. For Schwaller, the soul's journey, as seen by the Egyptians, was not a single ascent to heaven. That's the mainstream belief. Interestingly, that's also the mainstream belief, you know, in modern Christianity. But a repetitive process of refinement through multiple incarnations. He saw the Ka, Ba, and Ak, not just as soul fragments, but as stages of consciousness that evolve across lifetimes. The solar bark, mentioned in the quote, carries the sun god Ra across the sky by day and through the underworld by night. HPP here suggests that the daily voyage is a metaphor for the cycle of life, death, and rebirth. Ra's nightly battle with chaos, represented by the serpent Apep, who's pictured here, and Ra's rebirth at dawn, mirror the soul's passage through death of the incarnated Jiva and its return to the higher mental plane between incarnations. The phrase coeval with and disappearing with the solar boat suggests that the soul is eternal within the bounds of cosmic cycles. It exists as long as the solar boat sails, which is to say, as long as the universe continues its rhythmic unfolding. Any thoughts or questions about this?
Yes, please go ahead, Irina.
It's a quick question. The Schwaller de Lubitsch was mentioned in Blavatsky's work? I have all his books. He was much later living than Blavatsky.
Yeah. No, I brought him up because I'm familiar with his works.
Yeah, and it's amazing books. Thank you for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are incredible. He's very dense and can be difficult, but it's worth the effort. He packs a lot in, and he really was an extraordinary esotericist. Was it his niece, Isha de Schwaller de Lubitsch? Isha Schwaller de Lubitsch wrote this extraordinary two volumes called Hairback, Chickpea, and Hairback the Initiate, which really is like a close-up look at the life of an Egyptian initiate. Also dense because she was quite aware of her uncle's great work. Schwaller did things like he would analyze the relationship between hieroglyphs that appeared on one side of like an inner temple wall with what appeared directly opposite on the outside of that wall, right? Which, you know, nobody ever does that. So he would then combine those two meanings and found that they were significantly connected. So he really did things with the his fundamental premise was that these were great. This was a great esoteric mystery school, which most Egyptologists don't have that thought at all. They were primitive. They have this idea that civilization unfolds linearly. So if it came earlier, it was less evolved than what came later. That idea, which is very Western. He understood the importance of this whole Egyptian mystery school and was able to articulate it in his books. Plus, being a hands-on Egyptologist in Egypt. Okay, next. This soul emerges from the Tiau, the realm of the cause of life, and joins the living on earth by day to return to Tiau every night. This expresses a periodical existence of the ego. Book of the Dead. Let's see, what is that? 100 and what is that? 100. See, I think I wrote it. 100 and 6. I can't read it right now. Use of the term Tiau, that word, which we're here told means the realm of the cause of life, is unique to HPB. You don't find this word anywhere else. I give it a lot of credence because she had masters that worked with her out of form and probably revealed to her an esoteric Egyptian reality or word that hasn't come to light through archaeology. Actual Egyptian words with similar meanings are the duat, amenti, and the field of reeds. The key to this passage is the interpretation of the words day and night. To HPB, day represents incarnation, consciousness, and activity in the physical world, whereas night symbolizes death or withdrawal from physical life, with the term joins the living, meaning that the soul temporarily inhabits a body, thereby engaging in earthly existence. The citation from the Book of the Dead references spell 143, that's what that is. Which, according to HPB's interpretation, describes the soul's cyclical journey. Here's the spell 143 in hieroglyphics. Okay, any thoughts, questions, anybody? Right. Next up. The shadow, the astral form, is annihilated, devoured by the uraeus. The manas will be annihilated. Okay. Manas is a Latin term for the spirits of the dead, borrowed here to refer to disembodied souls or astral remnants. Spell 51 describes 14 mounds, each inhabited or guarded by distinct entities, serpent beings who breathe fire and other guardians. These mounds are initiatory gates that represent obstacles, trials, or stages of transformation, which the soul must confront and overcome in order to progress towards eternal life. Each mound is associated with a specific challenge or power. And by naming or invoking the beings within a particular mound, the deceased gains empowerment and protection. The 14th mound is described as the edge of all known things, guarded by beings whose eyes see truth and whose tongues speak flames. Okay. And finally, we have The two twins, the fourth and fifth principles, will be scattered, but the soul bird, the divine swallow, and the uraeus of flame, Manas and Atmabuddhi, will live in the eternity, for they are their mother's husbands. Okay, first of all, the two twins, or the fourth and fifth principles, refer to kama, the desire nature, and lower mind, which are often brought together. Scattered means disintegrated after death. The soul bird is a metaphor for the immortal aspect of the soul, whereas the divine swallow represents the soul in flight. The uraeus of flame is a symbol for divine wisdom and spiritual power, often depicted on the foreheads of the gods and pharaohs. Together, the swallow and the uraeus represent higher mind, buddhi, and atma, the higher principles which survive death. For they are their mother's husbands means that Atmabuddhi Manas is both born from and united with the mother aspect, the form aspect, and thus play a generative role in the evolution of consciousness, because the higher principles animate and spiritualize the lower quaternary. Okay, any thoughts or questions there? There's just a lot of symbolism in what she writes, right? So, you know, you have these two principles, kama manas, are scattered at death, but that higher aspect of the soul, as well as divine knowledge, live in eternity, for they are their mother's husbands, meaning that they are the progenitors of that which is sent, the principles that are incarnate. Any thoughts? She really packs the meaning in this very dense statements. Okay, let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the term their mother's husbands. Can we get a reader, please?
Nidhal, can you read that for us, please?
Another suggestive analogy between the Aryan or Brahmanical or Egyptian esotericism. The former call the Petries the lunar ancestors of men, and the Egyptians made of the moon god, Ta-Esmon, the first human ancestor. This moon god expressed the seven nature powers that were prior to himself and were summed up in him as his seven souls, of which he was the manifester as the eighth one, hence the eighth sphere. The seven rays of the Chaldean Heptarchus, or Lao, on the Gnostic stones indicate the same septenary of souls. The first form of the mystical seven was seen to be figured in heaven by the seven large stars of the Great Bear, the constellation assigned by the Egyptians to the mother of time and of the seven elemental powers, see the seven souls, etc. As well known to every Hindu, this same constellation represents in India the seven rishis, and as such is called Riksha and Chitra Sikandinas.
Thank you, Nidal. Okay, first, another suggestive analogy between the Aryan or Brahmanical and the Egyptian esotericism. The former call the Petries the lunar ancestors of man, and the Egyptians made of the moon god Ta-Esmun, the first human ancestor. Okay, the Brahmanical lunar Petries and the Egyptian Ta-Esmun both represent the builders of the form aspect. They're both representatives of the Dian Chohans and are thus humanity's ancestors from that point of view of they're the progenitors, the creators. Next. This moon god expressed the seven nature powers that were prior to himself and were summed up in him and his seven souls, of which he was the manifester as the eighth one, hence the eighth sphere. Okay, so Tot es Mun, the Egyptian moon god, who is an aspect of Toth, that's where the T-A-H-T comes in, Tot, in his role as lunar god, is a manifested synthesis of seven primordial forces, which are responsible for the seven human principles. Atma, Buddhi, Manas, Kama, Prana, Linga, and Stula, Sharira. The eighth sphere is where the spiritual inertia could trap the human soul if it chooses not to reascend through purification and conscious evolution. These seven souls or primordial sources are symbolized by the seven Elohim in the Kabbalah, the seven archangels in Christian mysticism, the seven rishis in Hindu cosmology, and the seven planetary spirits in Hermeticism. Each tradition encodes the idea that creation unfolds through seven archetypal stages or beings, and that the human soul is a microcosm of this divine architecture. The blind is really built into in all of these, you know, the Elohim, the archangels, the rishis. The blind is built in by imagining these as like gods, personifications, you know, and when in fact they represent these archetypal stages of becoming, right? These principles in man that we participate in. That's why our seven principles as human beings are like a microcosm of these greater seven. Okay. HPB seems to be implying, which he says, hence the eighth sphere, that the moon's role as the eighth expression of cosmic forces corresponds to the eighth sphere, a realm where the lower self becomes trapped in materiality and loses its connection to its higher principles, thus risking annihilation or at least dissolution until a future Manvantara. Actually, I think it's more accurate to say that prolonged and unwavering adherence to lunar or material expression after that part of one has been fully developed, because there's a period where that's an appropriate orientation, right? But if after that period has passed and one still adheres to material expression, then that can lead one to the godforsaken realm called the eighth sphere. That said, it's important to distinguish Toth as a synthesis of lunar forces from the eighth sphere. They're not at all the same thing. Toth is the god of wisdom, of writing, and lunar cycles. He governs time, measure, and cosmic law, whereas the eighth sphere is where soul-forsaken personalities, those who have severed ties with their higher spiritual principles, are drawn into finally after death. DK tells us that this most terrible of all possible scenarios, fortunately, is very, very rare. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Much has been hinted at in certain of our occult books about the eighth sphere. I would suggest that in this linking factor of intelligent mind, we have a clue to the mystery. When mind becomes unduly developed and ceases to unite the higher and the lower, it forms a sphere of its own. This is the greatest disaster that can overtake the human unit. Where dense materiality produces what we call wrong action, The gradual development of the spiritual consciousness will change darkness to light, and karma again is obviated. Where, however, it is the result of deliberate choice or a preference for wrong action, in spite of knowledge and in defiance of the voice of the spiritual nature, then this type of karma leads to what the Oriental occultists called avicii, or the eighth seer, a term synonymous with the Christian idea of the condition of being a lost soul. These cases are, however, exceedingly rare and have relation to the left-hand path and the practice of black magic. Though this condition involves the severing of the highest principle, that of pure spirit, from its two expressions, the soul and the body, or from the six lower principles, yet the life itself remains. And after the destruction of the soul in Avicii, a fresh cycle of becoming will again be offered.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay. Any thoughts or questions? All right.
Francis.
Yes.
I just wanted to say, God never gives up on us. We get opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to get it right.
Yeah, that's why it says it's very, very rare. You have to lifetime after lifetime work directly, shun the soul entirely. And this is after a period when you could make soul contact. Then it takes many lifetimes of going directly against the soul's efforts before, from atrophying, the cord snaps. And then you descend into this sphere, and you have to wait sometimes manvantaras before you are absorbed, reabsorbed, and in a sense start over. So yes, it's very rare.
Nadal, please go ahead.
Can you go back to the last page on the that we just read?
Sure.
What's the difference between, it says, when death materiality produces what we call wrong action, as opposed to intentionally doing wrong? I'm not sure I get the difference.
It has to do with awareness of the action that you're involved in. Let's see, let me read exactly. Wherever, how are the result of deliberate choice, is that what you're looking at?
Yeah.
Or of preference for wrong action. So this is the conscious black magician who is choosing to become a proponent of the form side, you know, through active evil, right? So that's deliberate wrong action. I mean, you know, we, if you're personality oriented, you do unconscious wrong actions constantly until you learn better, right? I mean, even in one lifetime, look at how your thoughts and speech and actions have changed, you know, over just the course of this one lifetime. You know, you've made the effort to clean up your act. This group consciously leans into onto the black path. And even then, you're given many, many lives, many chances to reverse your process. And for those very, very few who do not, then they end up in the eighth sphere. Did I answer your question?
I think so.
It has to do with conscious intent. So he really says it here, in spite of knowledge. So, you know, if you're just, like, say you're a gangster, you know, and you kill a bunch of people and you do a lot of evil, but you're not really in any kind of conscious awareness of where you are in your stage of becoming. You know, you've yet to develop any soul contact whatsoever, and you're just following what your environment presented to you. That's not this. That's not this description. It's when you become, in spite of knowledge, you become occultly aware, and then you defy the voice of the spiritual nature. It's presented and it's rejected. Then this type of karma leads to Avicii or the eighth sphere, right? In other words, the karma accrued by consciously denying, in defiance, the voice of the spirit of one's spiritual nature. So there's a whole developmental period when one naturally involves oneself in all kinds of what we would call evil action, really just wrong understanding. And then there's this whole other level that happens. The overwhelming majority of people, by the way, if you're into the unfolding of the petals of the egoic lotus, this happens at the fifth petal of the love petals, the central petal of the love tier of petals. So you have, the three lower petals, the three middle petals. So it's this, it becomes the fifth overall petal that you come face to face with this, because then the soul makes itself clear to you and you reject it. And many do this for a while and then in subsequent lives turn back to the soul after experiencing the negative effects. So it's not like, even in one life you could be, horrible. You could choose conscious black magic and harm a lot of people, right? But if in the next life, you begin to turn back to soul impress, then you're saved by that. It's only this persistent, consistent defiance that results in the eighth sphere. Okay. Okay, let's see here. Next, the seven rays of the Chaldean heptakis or Iao on the Gnostic stones indicate the same septenary of souls. So we've been talking about all these different expressions of the seven, right? Which are the seven principles. Up here it was like, the Elohim, the archangels, and the rishis are three ways in which they're described. So here we have yet an additional one, which is this Chaldean heptakis. Hep is always means seven, and the Iao. The Chaldean heptakis refers to the seven planetary spirits or powers that govern the visible cosmos. These are often linked to the Chaldean oracles, which describe a layered universe governed by divine intelligences. So it's right in line with the theosophy and occultism in general. Iao or Iao is a mystical name for the divine used in Gnostic and Hermetic texts. It's sometimes interpreted as a triple vowel formula, I, A, and O, representing creation, preservation, and dissolution. Gnostic stones are amulets or gems, often engraved with mystical symbols, divine names, and cosmic diagrams that frequently depict seven rays emerging from a lion-headed, serpent-bodied figure. The seven elements of the Chaldean heptakis are, at least exoterically, the seven planetary powers, each corresponding to both a ray of the divine and to a principle in man. Next. The first form of the mystical seven was seen to be figured in heaven, Oh, by the way, I just have to point this out. For those of you who have been are familiar with the second half of the esoteric astrology book, DK describes a triangle of descent from the Great Bear, passing through Leo to Shambhala. And notice that you have the and then on down through the to the head center of a human being and to the base of the spine. And notice the symbology here. You have the seven rays representing the great bear, the head of the lion representing Leo, and then the snake-like form representing the kundalini that connects the head center and the base of the spine. That just occurred to me. Okay. The first form of the mystical seven was seen to be figured in heaven by the seven large stars of the Great Bear, the constellation assigned by the Egyptians to the mother of time and of the seven elemental powers. So, the Egyptians associated the Great Bear with the mother of revolutions, which was sometimes linked with Isis or Hathor, who governed the cycles of time. The Great Bear's slow revolution around the pole star makes it like a cosmic clock that marks the yugas, ages, and world periods. Thus, the mother of time is the cosmic womb of cyclicity, right? Of the cycles that we are all bound by, the source of measured duration. Each of the Great Bear's seven stars were linked to one of the seven elemental creative powers, the forces that structure both cosmos and man. And theosophy does this too. This is, the Great Bears are in the primary causal position in both disciplines. In Chaldean and Egyptian thought, these were often identified with the seven planetary spirits or archons. In theosophy, they correspond to the seven rays, the seven principles of man, and are directly tied to the monads of the sacred seven planets of our solar system. So there's a deep tie between our solar system and the Great Bear. Finally, as is well known to every Hindu, this same constellation represents in India the seven rishis, and as such is called Riksha and Chitra Sikandinas. So in Hindu mythology, the seven stars of the Great Bear are called the Saptarishi Mandala, the circle of seven seers. Each star is identified with one of the seven sages, Atri, Bharadvaja, Gotama, Yamadagni, Kasyapa, and Vashtista, and Vishvamitra. Those are seven. These sages are regarded as progenitors of wisdom, transmitters of the Vedas, and guardians of cosmic law across the cycles of time. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Shirley, can you read that for us, please? Shirley? Okay, let's go to Tom. Tom, can you read that for us, please?
I'm
There we go,
sorry.
Shirley.
I'm sorry. I have to leave now. Sorry.
Okay, bye.
Excuse me. Bye-bye.
Tom? Tom? Can you read that?
Like alone produces like. The earth gives man his body, his gods, Jnanis, his five inner principles, the psychic shadow of which those gods are often the animating principle. Spirit, Atman is one and indiscrete. It is not in the Tao. What is the Tao? The quick allusion to it in the Book of the Dead contains a mystery. Tao is the path of the night sun, the inferior hemisphere of the infernal region of the Egyptians, placed by them on the concealed side of the moon. The human being in their esotericism came out from the moon, a triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical at once. He crossed the whole cycle of existence and then returned to his birthplace before issuing from it again. Thus, the defunct is shown arriving in the West, receiving his judgment before Osiris, resurrecting as the god Horus, and circling round the sidereal heavens, which is an allegorical assimilation to Ra, the sun. Then, having crossed the Nut, celestial abyss, returning once more to Tiau, an assimilation to Osiris, who, as the god of life and reproduction, inhabits the moon.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, first, like alone produces like. The earth gives man his body, the gods, Dhyanis, his five inner principles, the psychic shadow, of which those gods are often the animating principle. Spirit, Atman, is one and indiscrete. It is not in the Tiau. Okay, so like alone produces like means that each plane or principle can only produce its own kind, sheaths out of its own substance. Therefore, the earth, meaning the physical plane, gives man his dense physical body, and the Dhyanis give man his five inner principles. The quote-unquote psychic shadow refers to the lower mental and astral sheaths that are animated by the Dhyanis. Spirit, Atman, is one, and indiscrete means that it is indivisible. The Tiau is a place of testing, purification, and transition. Atman is not in the Tiau because it has transcended these conditions. Any thoughts, questions? It's a very dense section of the text. Next, for what is the Tiau? The frequent allusion to it in the Book of the Dead contains a mystery. Tiau is the path of the night sun, the inferior hemisphere, or the infernal region of the Egyptians, placed by them on the concealed side of the moon. Isn't that interesting? So the Egyptians believed that the sun traveled through the unseen occult side of existence during the night, which they called the Duat. HPB associates this phase of the sun's journey with the dark or concealed side of the moon, suggesting a hidden astral-like realm through which the soul passes before its rebirth at dawn. Note the two serpents in this frieze depicting Ra's journey through the night. The threatening upright serpent within the enclosure is Apep, who is trying to swallow the sun, in other words, obliterate solar consciousness. This is the force of chaos and destruction that Ra must overcome each quote unquote night, which can also be construed as each incarnation. Mehen is the protective serpent who coils around Ra's enclosure. His role is to shield the sun god from Apep's assault. You could say the enclosure itself is a kind of shield, and yet Apep is shown within that shield because it arises within the consciousness of the god, sun god itself. Next, the human being in their esotericism came out from the moon, a triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical at once. He crossed the whole cycle of existence and then return to his birthplace before issuing from it again. This is a complex, multi-layered statement. So first, the human being came out from the moon. Refers to the past in general and to the moon chain in particular, the realm of humanity's previous development, and to where the form aspect was focused upon and developed. As to a triple mystery, astronomical, physiological, and psychical, astronomically, the moon is a remnant of the moon chain, a dead body that once sustained life. Though physiologically, it still influences the human body by regulating fertility cycles, tides, and other growth rhythms. Psychically, the moon symbolizes the astral body, memory, and past karmic residues. He crosses the whole cycle of existence, refers to the rounds and races where the long pilgrimage of the soul takes place. Return to his birthplace before issuing from it again suggests that before the soul can move forward into higher evolution, it must return again and again to resolve its lunar inheritance, the karmic, astral, and bodily residues of the past. Only then can it, quote unquote, issue forth again into a new cycle of spiritual life. When the heart is as light as a feather, meaning when all attachment to the lower realms, to personality existence has been superseded. Okay, any thoughts or questions? Okay, next up. Yeah, I see a hand.
It's me.
Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, my mind for the last few minutes has been playing with alphabet. When you first mentioned EIO, I thought, yeah, I'm always saying AEIOU. And that led me into alphabets. And I guess I would even go just as a hint, where did Sanskrit, for example, come from? And somehow this is almost as if our languages express the creation from the beginning.
Yeah. The vowels are the, and DK tells us in Initiation Human and Solo that the vowels are the energy source of words, right? That the consonants provide the form aspect and the vowels attenuate or describe, that's not the right word. It makes particular the nature of the energy that is enclosed in the consonant form aspect of the word, right? So when you have a word like E-I-O, you have the three fundamental energetic aspects. I really think this is descriptive of the three principles, right? Spirit, form, and that which relates the two, which is consciousness, right? So yeah, and you know, it's interesting that this word tiao has all the vowels except e, I-E-A-O-U, right? I-E-A-O-U, even right in order, except for the E is taken out. That's interesting.
I will add to that, and this will extend it. Maybe you don't want to go there. But when I thought about, let's see, numbers and the seven chakras or the five chakras, then I realized that first we have a consonant, then we have a vowel. And we have, in essence, we have consonants on both ends of the five vowels or the three.
What do you mean? What consonant?
Okay, let's go for it. Let's say that E-I-O, you have a consonant before that. That's the one. And then you get the first sound is the vowel, and then another consonant, and you keep going, and at the very end, you add a consonant again. So if you have three vowels, you are somehow energizing five activities.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, right. A lot of the sacred words in Sanskrit, like for instance, the word for the heart is anahata. It's
Yes.
the sacred is represented by the A, and it's all A vowels. So it's conditioned as it passes through the word by a series of consonants, right? A in A, H, A, T, A, in beginning and ending with spirit, you could say, but conditioned along the way. And that particular description encodes the energy of the heart in Sanskrit, right? Which is, I think, probably the closest language we have that's been given to what is a obviously the superior language of the initiates, which is Sinzar, where it's the words are actually ideographs that are energetically charged with the source of their meaning. They're not just descriptions of the meaning, but they're energetically charged with the source of their meaning. Thank you.
Anahata it immediately brings another thought, and that simply is that what's the first letter of Om? Om.
Yeah, and that it means the same thing. The A is the source, the spirit aspect. The U is the consciousness aspect, and the M represents the form nature. So, the A has the same meaning both in both Sanskrit words. Yeah, it's a fascinating way to explore Sanskrit.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think this is a good place to stop since, we had this discussion right at this point.
Okay, I just want to say Ben typed a comment. He said Egyptian logo consonantal writing vowels added from context. Please explain that, Ben.
Logo consonantal. I like that word. Logo consonantal.
The
Yes, Ben.
consonants of the logo.
If you look at hieroglyphics, there are no vowels.
Yeah, right. It's that's right. So you're saying
They knew.
that the vowels are added for from context or in order to provide context. In other words, all you have the form and the hidden, the mystery that is withheld is the energetic source of that form.
It's like that TV show where they have the hidden message and you
Yeah.
have to figure it out from a couple of letters.
Right, that's it. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Okay, let me think here. We're November 16th, so we have a stretch.
Yeah.
You want to get the dates, PL?
Sure, we have a treatise of cosmic fire is going to be on the 28th of November. The next secret teaching of all ages will be 7 December, and both of those are going to be at 8. And we're actually still negotiating for the next secret doctrine. It would normally be on the 21st of December, but there's a number of events going on then, so we're possibly going to change it to the 14th.
Yeah, that would be a choice.
But we have events then too, so we
Be,
have
stay
to do
tuned.
conflict, huh?
Stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly. I'll send the invitation out once we decide. Well, I'll send it out a week before once we decide what the date will be, and then the reminder on the day of the date and time. So,
Yeah,
thank you, everybody, and
if
thank
you
you,
get emails
Francis.
from Constant Contact, I always want to say Constant Comment, but it's not the T, it's the app that sends these things out. Just notice that there will be a change for the secret doctrine. But otherwise, I think things are pretty much on schedule, just that one difference. Yeah, thank you all.
Thank you, everybody.
And we'll see you next time. Be well.
Bye.
Thank you.